Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our headquarters overlooking San Francisco's Financial District. I am John Diaz, your quarterly chair. It is also my pleasure to welcome those listening on radio throughout the country joining us for America's longest-running radio program. We invite all those listening on radio, as well as those here in our audience at the Commonwealth Club, to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. Ambassador Vicki Huddleston had one of the more challenging jobs in international diplomacy, even before a certain six-year-old boy was found clinging to an inner tube at sea last Thanksgiving. Diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba have been anything but normal since January 1961, when the two countries officially closed their embassies. The past 40 years of relations between these two countries have been characterized by embargoes, charges and countercharges of subversive activities, and enough crises to keep the U.S. interest section in Havana, one of the busiest embassies, make that unofficial embassy, on the island. And then came Elian Gonzalez. Fortunately, the chief of this important mission, Ambassador Huddleston, is a stranger to neither Cuba nor difficult issues. She is a career Foreign Service officer whose portfolio made her ideally suited to the Havana post when she took command in September 1999. She had worked on Cuban affairs at the State Department from 1989 to 1993, serving the last 2 years as director. And that was only one of her, shall we say, challenging experiences. Before taking over the Cuban mission, she had been Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and she was Ambassador to Madagascar from 1995 to 1997. Yes, that word challenging keeps coming up in describing Vicki Huddleston's career as a Foreign Service officer. She was the Deputy Chief of Mission in Haiti during the deployment of the multinational force in the early 1990s. Sierra Leone, she was there too, once serving as chief of the economic section. Her hard work and successes have certainly not gone unnoticed or unrewarded. Vicki Huddleston has won numerous honors for her diplomatic service, including an award for valor for her work in Haiti. It is safe to say that the challenge in Cuba will not end if and when Elian and his father return home. After a 40-year chill, U.S.-Cuba relations do appear to be entering a period of reassessment and transition. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you the American diplomat who is on the front lines at this critical moment, the principal officer of the United States Interest Section in Havana, Ambassador Vicki Huddleston.
Thank you very much. Thank you, John. I also, may I add, that I'm also a native daughter of California. I was born in San Diego. Now, you may have noticed in those slides that we were looking at that a park has been built in front of the United States Interest Section. We call it the Protestodrome. The Cubans call it the Plaza de la Dignidad José Martí. And it consists of a huge stage and four huge arches. And each one of these arches, according to the Cuban government, is for each decade a perfidy of the United States against Cuba. And at the end of the plaza is José Martí, the great Cuban hero, holding a child in his arms and pointing an accusing finger at the interest section. Now, according to Cuban wags, José Martí is saying to the child, that's where you get the visas. After 41 years of revolution, there is only one fundamental question for the United States policy toward Cuba, and that question is how to promote a peaceful transition to a democratic government. The Halcyon days of the revolution are over. There are no longer Cuban troops in Angola or Ethiopia. Elections have been held in Chile and Nicaragua. The missile crisis is gone and finished, and the Soviet Union is too. Cuba no longer has the subsidy of $4 to $5 billion a year that it had during the days of the Soviet Union. Now the revolution and Castro have entered the winter of the revolution. They have survived the special period in time of peace when Cubans had not enough to eat, little electricity, almost no transportation other than bicycles. And they survived during this period by making adaptions. The economy of Cuba was dollarized, allowing dollars and pesos to circulate freely. Foreign investment was encouraged, particularly in the tourism area. Limited private investment was permitted, particularly for people to run restaurants in their homes or to rent out rooms. And so some modifications were made. This allowed the revolution to survive. But now Castro has to look around and say, how do I preserve the revolution and hand down my legacy to the Cuban youth? Because for Castro, it is not change, it is handing on Cuban communism to the youth of Cuba. First, he looked to the past, to Che Guevara, to Celia Sanchez, to Cienfuegos, to the great heroes of the revolution. And then he looked to his arch enemy, the United States. And he began first with the demanda, which is a series of court cases in Cuba that asked the United States to pay reparations to Cuba in the billions of dollars for injuries suffered allegedly from Bay of Pigs, from the embargo, and from other alleged crimes of the United States government. This did not catch the imagination of the Cuban people, nor did the billboards I often see which say, El bloqueo es genocidio, the embargo is genocide. Castro then turned to pinpointing the brave human rights activist in Cuba in the hopes that that way he could point out to the youth of Cuba that there were subversives in the government. This too failed, because when he denounced the human rights activists for a press conference during Governor Ryan's visit to Cuba, many human rights activists in Chile, in Mexico, in Portugal, and in Spain then protested to their governments. And as a result, the heads of those governments or the foreign ministers of those governments met with these human rights activists when they came to Cuba for the Ibero-American Summit. And as a result, the Ibero-American Summit was as much a victory for the human rights activists in Cuba as it was for the Cuban government. But then fate handed Castro a very large stick. And that stick was, as John mentioned, Elian Gonzalez, the shipwrecked child. And immediately, Castro understood the value of this propaganda, because this put him on center stage. This allowed him to mobilize the Cuban population, but in particular, the Cuban youth. And that is the direction that he wants to mobilize, to give them a purpose, to renew the revolution. So over a 6-month period now, we've had marches in every major Cuban city. We've had roundtables every night, every day. We've had Castro center stage with this great publicity issue in which he can attack not only the United States government, but the Cuban-American community as well. Cubans know what's going on. Yes, most Cubans would like to see Elian Gonzalez come back to Cuba. But also, Cubans understand that this is an organized activity of the Cuban government. In fact, I find Cuban humor very revealing. For example, 30, 40 years from now, according to Cubans, there is a middle-aged fellow in front of the United States intersection, and he's saying, Devuelve Elian, Devuelve Elian, return Elian, return Elian. And so a young Cuban comes up to this man and he says, but viejo, Eliane came back 30 years ago. Yo say, I'm Eliane. The revealing thing is nothing has changed. It's still the intersection. It's still the protest. Nothing has changed. Well, if the fundamental of Cuba policy for the Cuban government and for Fidel Castro is nothing changes, the fundamental of U.S. policy is everything changes. United States policy toward Cuba is no different than United States policy around the world, toward China, toward Brazil, toward Peru, toward Kosovo. There are three pillars of the United States policies. Number one, promotion of human rights, democracy, and rule of law. Number two, promotion of open economic and communication systems. And number three, a reduction of global scourges to the environment of disease and terrorism and crime around the world. How do we do it in Cuba? On the human rights front, we have supported human rights activists in Cuba since we opened the intersection in 1977. There are about 400 political prisoners now in Cuba by our calculations. What we do is lend moral support. We also encourage our allies, the Europeans and the Latin Americans and others, to support these brave human rights activists who are trying to push for a bit more political space. The checks and the polls were successful with our help in passing a resolution in Geneva that supported the release of these dissidents and condemned Cuba for its human rights abuses. Probably as a direct result of that, three of the human rights activists who wrote the tract, La Patria es de Todo, the country of Cuba is for everyone, have been released from prison. On the democracy side, we feel that the best way to support democracy in Cuba is through the People to People program. And of course, that's how I know Harry and a number of you, because you came down to the San Francisco Global Trade Council. And I'm delighted to see the Commonwealth Club is also going to sponsor a trip in January of this year. This is a wonderful way to get information, to get ideas into the Cuban people. We have similar values of religion. We have similar values in art and in culture. We have experiences we need to exchange in medicine, in education, with our youth, with women. There across the board are ways that we can help Cubans develop civil society, which governance is all about, through the People to People program. It is fundamental to letting the Cubans begin to learn how to govern themselves. What are we doing on open economic and communication systems? And I can see you looking at me and saying, the embargo does not lend itself to open economic systems. Let me just say that the purpose at this point of the embargo of Cuba, the U.S. embargo of Cuba, is simply to deny foreign investment, trade, and finance that will build up the regime, because we do not want to see this regime, which is an oppressive regime, become stronger. We want to see a transition. There are a number of exceptions so that the Cuban people can benefit. First of all, $700 to $800 million come from the United States a year in the form of remittances to the Cuban people. United States citizens and permanent residents may make remittances to the Cuban people. Secondly, the United States people and NGOs are the largest donor of humanitarian goods to Cuba of any nation in the world. We donate to Cuba, or we have donated to Cuba, about $2.5 billion worth of goods since 1992. We also now allow the sale of medicines to Cuba. What do we do for the open communication side? The United States government has stated that individually and collectively, individuals and companies may negotiate for the placement of a fiber optic cable to Cuba. And you as Californians must know better than anyone else the importance of getting in information, the importance of getting in technology to any country, particularly into Cuba, which in essence is a closed society. Prior to the revolution, Cuba had 58 television newspapers and 28 television stations. Today, Cuba has 2 television stations and a handful of newspapers, all controlled by the government, all with mainly news about Cuba and little international news. With more communications through the people-to-people program and people like you who visit Cuba, and more information through the internet and through television and radio, Cuba can join the global community. And third, how do we help Cuba reduce global threats? Through the United States intersection, we have a migration agreement with Cuba. It was signed in 1994, after the mass migration in early 94, in which 30,000 Cubans came to the United States illegally. This was preceded by the mass migration of 1980, in which 127 Cubans came illegally to the United States. Under the agreement with the Cuban government discourages illegal exit and takes back to Cuba those individuals who have gone illegally with a promise not to retaliate against them. For our part, we offer 20,000 resident visas a year to the Cuban population. For the first lottery, we had over 500,000 people apply. We are also, in order to allow family visits, providing more and more visas for visitors, particularly for people over 60 and 65. This allows grandparents to see children and grandchildren in the United States. In addition, over 100,000 Cuban Americans visit Cuba annually. We also cooperate with Cuba on reducing global threats from narcotics by counter-narcotics cooperation. And I will shortly have on my staff a Coast Guard officer who will help in this effort. In addition, the Smithsonian has worked with Cuba before the revolution and during the revolution on the environment. And in fact, the coastal laws of Cuba are somewhat similar to coastal laws in California, which I understand are quite progressive, because the Smithsonian has used this as a model to help Cuban environmentalists write their own laws. These strategies, as I said, have one goal, the goal of peaceful transition to democracy. But this is not the vision of the Castro government. The vision of Castro government at this point is that power will be handed off to Raul Castro, who is the brother of Fidel Castro. Raul Castro has been a communist even before the revolution and is Minister of Defense. After that, according to some members of the Politburo, power may devolve to some of the other members of the Politburo. But basically, there is no change. The system stays the same. What does this mean for change in Cuba? This means that it is possible that Cuba could become unstable, because the advantage, at least right now, is that Cuba is in fact stable. There could be violence in a power struggle. There could be settling of scores. Cuba could harbor terrorism, or it could harbor crime. We have much at stake, and so does the Cuban people, and certainly greatly are concerned with the fact that at this moment there is not a viable transition in Cuba. To compound this, Cuba does not have a history of democracy nor of self-government. The Spanish ruled in Cuba until 1902, and that's pretty late for the Western Hemisphere. With the Treaty of Paris, the United States was in fact the dominant power in Cuba until the Platt Amendment was abrogated. From 1935 to 1959, Batista ruled most of the time. There were a few Democratic governments, but that was all. From 1959, you know the history. It was the Soviet Union until 1992, and now Cuba, for the first time, is on its own, but on its own with the same regime that was installed in the early 60s. So if I can't reassure you about the transition, I can, however, assure you that the types of policies the United States government is carrying out, the strategies that I outlined to you for promotion of human rights and democracy, of open economic and communication systems, of reduction of global threats, are in fact the best way, number one, to help in a transition in which the Cuban people will be able to govern themselves, and number two, will allow the United States government, through its limited links with the Cuban government, to reduce those threats of massive migration or terrorism or narco trafficking. But let me just stop for a minute and tell you what my personal vision of Cuba is in the 21st century. I think that we should look to the past to see what Cuba might be in the 21st century. Before the revolution in 1958, Cuba had very high levels of literacy and education. That has been expanded and deepened by the Cuban government. I have no doubt that in the future this will continue. Prior to the revolution, Cuba was exporting as much as Mexico. Now Mexico exports 130 times more than Cuba. Prior to the revolution, Cuba had the third greatest amount of foreign exchange and gold reserves in Latin America. Today, it is dead last. But I think we can see, when we look at the success of Cuban Americans in the United States and the ingenuity of Cubans in Cuba, for those of you who have visited, that Cuba, in fact, will be an economic powerhouse under a free and open economic system. And then finally, what I see in Cuba are shared values. I see these divided communities and divided families coming together with amity and with friendship, working together to build upon shared values so that Cubans can decide on their own future and so that Cuba in the 21st century will be open and free. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vicki Huddleston, Principal Officer, United States Interest Section, Havana, Cuba, for your thoughtful presentation. Now, Terry Carl, who is director of the Center for Latin American Studies at Stanford University, is going to conduct a question and answer session. Terry?
We've got quite a few. Thank you, John. John Diaz is our quarterly chairman. Ms. Huddleston, we have a large number of questions here, which I am still sorting, and I'm going to try to put a little bit of order into them because some of the same ones keep coming up. Several days ago, or actually about a week ago in the China debates, we saw an interesting phenomena, and I'm summing up a number of questions here when I say this. We saw Tom DeLay arguing vehemently for normalizing relations with China, but at the same time working very hard for against any efforts to end the blockade against Cuba. We have a number of questions here asking about that distinction, and in particular,
I have to say, is not a blockade, just an embargo.
Well, there's a difference in opinion here. The Cubans call it a blockade, and the Americans call it an embargo. However, the key question here is that Tom DeLay said the distinction that between the two was so obvious that he didn't have to comment on it. Why we would normalize relations with China and not normalize relations with Cuba? Could you explain that distinction to us? And there are a number of questions here calling for the normalization of relations with Cuba and asking under what conditions such normalization could proceed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First of all, why do we call it an embargo and not a blockade? We had a blockade against Cuba during the missile crisis. That's when you have ships out in the waters preventing other ships from coming into the territories of the country they are blockading. And other countries, of course, can trade with Cuba. It's just the United States that can't trade with Cuba. And, of course, the embargo, the history of the embargo is that the embargo was put on in the early 60s after the United States waited for some time, and there had been a number of expropriations. But the United States kept hoping that it wouldn't turn into a communist revolution. But then when the Cuban government refused to refine the United States companies refused oil companies to refine oil from the Soviet Union, and then Cuba nationalized these oil companies, and that was when the embargo began. And the embargo has gone through different phases. There's been the time when Castro and Cuba were in Africa and were in Latin America as well, spelling a threat, in fact, to the United States during the Cold War. Now we don't see Cuba so much as a threat. What we don't want to do, however, as I mentioned in my remarks, is build up the economy of the Cuban government, because this government is a government that we would like to see a transition from into democracy. Now, why is it different from China? First of all, the Secretary of State said, we don't have a cookie-cutter policy. We don't have the same policy for all countries around the world. Cuba is very close. China is very far from the United States. We have a lot of different issues with Cuba than we have with China. But essentially, what you find in China is an opening up on the economic side. In Cuba, you do not find an opening up on the economic side. What you find in Cuba is rather a commitment to the revolution as it is. In communist jargon, it's the thesis, the antithesis, and then the synthesis. The Cuban Revolution is the end of history. If we were seeing real changes in Cuba, there would be considerably more possibility for seeing an end to the embargo.
Several more questions on the embargo, and let me link the two of them together. Are there any positive effects of the long embargo maintained practically alone by the United States, asks one questioner. And a second is, if Cuba is responding, this goes directly to your last remarks, actually, if Cuba is responding to the fall of the Soviet Union by opening its economy and allowing private enterprise in certain key areas of the economy, why doesn't the United States respond to those kinds of initiatives from the Cuban government?
Can you tell me this?
Any positive effects of the long embargo?
Okay. The positive effect, and it's hard to argue, but because we don't have a calculus of what the embargo's done and what the embargo hasn't done. The Cubans have a calculus of that. That's the demanda, in which they're asking for reparations from the United States government. But you can make a very solid argument that with the embargo, the United States has kept the pressure on. That, in fact, had the United States not kept the pressure on the way it has, the Pope's visit would not have been as successful as it has been, nor would the human rights activists have as much freedom, which is limited, as they have. Because by keeping the pressure on the government has been forced into some kinds of reforms on the religious side and a little more opening on the human rights side. The Catholic Church is, in fact, the only independent institution outside the government of Cuba. When the Pope came to Cuba, he gave thousands of people real hope of freer expression, of freer lives in Cuba. I doubt that without the embargo, that society would have allowed enough opening, or Castro would have allowed enough opening in the society to have allowed a successful visit of the Pope. So that's my easy answer on how the embargo has perhaps helped the situation in Cuba. It is a nice juxtaposition with our European allies, because the Europeans are also working to broaden the base of society, to prepare the Cubans to better govern themselves, to prepare for private enterprise. But even the Europeans say what has happened so far in Cuba is not something that is moving forward. In fact, the Europeans all tell me that over the last 18 months, the government has in fact rolled back the openings on the private initiative side. And the figures indicate that from 270,000 private enterprises in Cuba, it has now gone down to 150,000. So that would seem to be correct, that orthodoxy, at least for the moment in Cuba, has ascendancy.
We have some more questions on the embargo. What is the policy towards pharmaceuticals coming from the United States? I visited Cuba, and I've been in places where people have no medicines. This is part of U.S. policy. Can you tell me how this will change?
Well, first of all, as I indicated, we are the largest donor, humanitarian donor to Cuba, and most of this is in medicine. Secondly, we do permit the sale of medicines to Cuba. In fact, there was this wonderful pharmaceutical show in Cuba last January. I had in my house about 300 American businessmen and women, and that must have been the first time in 40 years we've had businessmen and women from the United States in the residence of the principal officer, which used to be the residence of the ambassador. So overall, the pharmaceutical companies of the United States can sell to Cuba. The major question here is, why aren't these sales going through? Is it too much complicated paperwork on the United States side? Or is it because all imports into Cuba must be approved by the government that there is adequate foreign exchange to do so? It may well be that Cuban government is limiting the amount of foreign exchange available for medical imports, as it has in the past. Because basically the Cuban government is very well aware that many people in the United States will send medicines down to Cuba. In fact, those 100,000 Cuban Americans that visit every year, almost every one of them brings medicines with them when they go to Cuba.
There are several questions on the promotion of democracy in Cuba. Those questions revolve around the following themes. The first is, are we really trying to promote democracy in Cuba, or is this another reason to prolong a policy towards Cuba, which seems, this writer says, to be motivated by hatred of Fidel Castro more than anything else? Let me give you a couple of other questions that are around the same theme. In terms of the promotion of democracy in Cuba, which is currently considered one, I think, as you said, one of the key aims of the United States foreign policy, today in Latin America, as you know, the elections in Peru were widely denounced as fraudulent. Venezuela has just canceled its elections. Ecuador had a military coup and installed a vice president who is considered pretty much of a fig leaf of democratic transition. Colombia is calling for the dissolving the Congress, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in a hemisphere in which the promotion of democracy seems to be in acute crisis, particularly in the Andean region, how is it possible to single out Cuba for promotion of democracy without subsequently also punishing in some way these regimes?
Well, let me just start with the first one. I think there are some people that hate Fidel Castro. The United States policy isn't based on hating Fidel Castro. The United States policy is based on the type of regime that is in Cuba and the best way, we believe, for changing that type of regime. And the best way, we believe, to change that type of regime is to get in information, to get in ideas, is to allow the Cuban people to begin to have some political space, to begin to have the right to form their own kind of organizations and things like that. If the United States government hates anything, and I sort of hate the word hate, it's the type of regime that exists in Cuba and the desire to see the Cuban people have something better than that. Now, with the rest of Latin America, I think you will see that we've taken a very firm stand on Peru and around Latin America to encourage democracy. Latin America went from almost only half democratic to all democratic except Cuba. And as you point out, Terry, now there are some crises in Latin America. There's Venezuela, there's Peru. And now what we need to do in Latin America, and I hope we're doing effectively, is work with these countries to assure that these democracies do survive. Because, paraphrasing, democracy is the worst type of government until you see all the other types of government, and then you know it's the best.
We have several questions regarding the Miami Cubans and, in particular, their influence on both our policy and the policy of the Cuban government. One question asks that many Cubans in Cuba would like to see changes, this writer believes, but they're afraid of the powerful right-wing Cubans in Miami taking over. 60 Minutes has portrayed this group as virtually fascistic, intolerant of dissidents, and Human Rights Watch has attributed a number of unsolved murders to this group. A Miami newspaper editor said on 60 Minutes that he had received death threats from supporters of this group, and it was widely reported that the INS officer who carried Elian Gonzalez out of the home of the Miami relatives also has received a number of death threats and has had to move her her residence. The question is, what is the impact of this group on U.S. policy, and how do they influence visions inside Cuba?
Well, I often like to say that everybody's Cuban. The government of Cuba is Cuba, and the Cuban Americans still retain a lot from Cuba. And this, in many ways, is a family fight and a community fight. I believe, from what I've seen of Cuban Americans and those that have come down like you all have under the People to People, that there are many, many, many Cuban Americans that really want to see this solved and solved in a peaceful way that's going to bring democracy to Cuba. They don't feel a great animosity. They feel a great loss. They want to see something better like all of us in this room do for Cuba. Yes, the Cuban Americans are an important lobby. They're financially strong and they hold an important voter sector in the state of Florida. I think we all know that, and they have a lot of influence over U.S. policy, just like many other exile groups. The Jewish lobby has an impressive amount of influence over U.S. policy in the Middle East. Turkish and Greek exile groups do their very, very best to have a lot of influence over U.S. policy toward those countries. Does the Cuban American lobby have more power than any other group? I would say it doesn't have more power than the Jewish lobby. I think they're about equal in their importance in influencing the Congress. And that's our way. That's our American system. If you are interested in changing American policy, if you don't agree with American policy on Cuba, it is not just the executive branch. It is Congress as well. Cuba policy has been legislated by the Helms-Burton Act as well as by the Cuba Democracy or Torricelli Law. So there are two congressional laws passed that govern our policy toward Cuba in addition to the implementation of Cuba policy by the executive branch. So I can push this one right back into your hands. Those of you who are concerned about U.S. policy or about the embargo, it is in your hands as well as in my hands to change or modify Cuban policy if there are things that you don't agree with. If there are things that you do agree with and you think that this is a way to bring about the transition that I'm talking about, then your support is also welcome.
Bernard Aronson, who was Assistant Secretary of State under the Bush administration, recently wrote an op-ed piece which received a great deal of attention. That piece said and warned that the Elian Gonzalez case put into question the capacity of the U.S. government to deal with a future crisis or a transition in Cuba, given the huge levels of distrust that exist between Miami Cubans and the U.S. government. In particular, he painted two scenarios in which, if there is a future crisis in Cuba, small boats might be leaving from Miami either to try to rescue relatives or to try to fight in some kind of armed conflict. He said that the inability to deal with this community from the point of view of the U.S. government actually raised questions about the U.S. government could have, whether it could have a clear policy in a moment of crisis. Could you comment on that?
Well, I haven't heard all of Bernie's comments, and I used to work for him. When I was director of Cuban affairs, he was the assistant secretary for Latin America. And so I know him and respect him, but also know him as a boss during the time that I was doing Cuba in the Department of State. There are plans in effect, emergency plans, for dealing with that probability or possibility that there would be great disruption in Cuba, and then boats might come from Cuba as well as boats might come from the United States. And so there are contingency plans that involve both the Coast Guard and possibly even the United States Navy in that kind of situation, as well as domestic agencies.
The United States singles out Cuba in two respects, one for its violation of human rights, and the other is that Cuba is still among nations singled out by the United States for sponsoring terrorism. In a comparative study, Cuba's human rights violations are not as egregious as those, say, in Colombia. Furthermore, terrorism in Cuba, examples of Cuban terrorism sponsored from the government seem to be very few and very far between, if they exist at all. Could you comment on this?
Basically, that's correct. Cuba is on the terrorist list for acts committed some 20 years ago, and it continues on the terrorist list because it still harbors some terrorists in Cuba and has not taken any steps against them. But the issue is principally what happened in the past and not what has happened in the future. How long it will continue in the terrorist list, I'm unsure, but certainly it would be very helpful if those terrorists that are harbored still in Cuba were returned to the United States to serve judicial process.
If there are no current or even recent examples of government-sponsored terrorism, why doesn't the United States use this as lifting Cuba from the list as one overture towards normalizing, to the long road of normalizing relations?
Well, basically, as I said, there's still terrorists harbored in Cuba, but you know, it's the whole issue of normalization of relations. I think the United States, with the new measures that we have introduced over the last 2 years, 18 months, have made enormous overture, in fact. Now people like yourselves and groups like yourself go to Cuba and you see for yourself. You have this contact. You have this ability to make these judgments for yourself. We have daily flights from Miami on the charter to Cuba. We now have expanded that to New York and to Los Angeles as well. We've offered Cuba direct mail service, but so far Cuba hasn't accepted that. We are looking for all sorts of ways in which we can promote this kind of contact that in a logical way will help Cuba expand some civil society. Now, Cuba's reaction is, we don't like the people-to-people program. But in fact, because they have some benefit on their side, they have allowed the people-to-people program to go forward.
This person says, I visited Cuba during the reign of Batista. Castro, with all his faults, is better, or rather, Cuba is better under Castro than Batista. Do you agree? And I would also like to add another question to that. In recent studies by the World Bank, in its comparative social indicators for Latin America, Cuba ranks virtually first in adult literacy, in its adult literacy rate, comparable to Argentina, which has a GNP which is significantly larger. Cuba has the highest number of mean years of schooling. It has the longest life expectancy. It has the lowest infant mortality of children under five. It has the lowest relationship of population per doctor. Some of that certainly indicates that this government has made a significant effort to try to deal with the needs of its own people, regardless of how we may feel about its political regime. Could you comment, first of all, on whether you think things are better than they were under Batista, and second of all, whether you think governments, or whether you think it should be a part of U.S. policy that governments that actually do address basic human needs of its own people, that that's something that should be factored in on the issue of the normalization of relations?
Well, both Batista and Castro are dictators, or were dictators in the case of one of the right and one of the left. And we shouldn't have any truck with either kind of dictator, whether they're of the right or the left. The difference I see is that Batista was a more active person who was carrying out human rights abuses to include torture and arbitrary killing. At this point, that's not happening in Cuba. People are imprisoned, but I'm not hearing a lot about torture. I'm not hearing about arbitrary killings, things like that. Where the oppression exists in Cuba is freedom. Freedom to move, freedom to talk, freedom to invest in your own enterprise, freedom to do what you want to do as an individual. Cuba is a leader still in the third world, not in the way it was during the time in Africa of Angola and Ethiopia, but it is a leader in helping third world countries articulate their demands or desires to the developed world for better health care, for more assistance in education, for better literacy, for the things, Terry, that you pointed out. Yes, Cuba has done an excellent job across the board on health and education, but Cuba's infant mortality rate in 58 was one of the best in the world. So they had a good basis to develop from. And they also had an enormous amount of Soviet aid to use to carry this out. As some of you will have seen, there's a lot of deterioration in the education and in the health sectors at this time. But still, life expectancy is very, very good in Cuba. And that is one of the things that, as I said toward the end of my remarks, I hope that Cuba will keep in the 21st century, is this ability that it has to provide the necessary education and health care for its people. It indeed is impressive, but it has come at a significant sacrifice of the Cuban people as far as their individual liberty goes.
When members of different groups were in Cuba recently, the Cuban government complained about visas being issued from the U.S. interest section. In particular, they argued that tragedies like the which were brought up by the Elian Gonzalez case, like the death of Elian's mother, were in part the responsibility of the United States not issuing enough visas or quickly enough for people who do want to leave Cuba. You said today that 20,000 visas are permitted. This person writes that that, is it true that an average of 9,000 per year have been issued in the past? And if so, why is the full quota not being met, or has that changed?
Well, we're very proud of this, actually. First of all, under the migration accords, we issue 20,000 visas to Cubans who wish to come to the United States to live, to stay. This is more than any other country in the world. Any other country in the world, you must be an immediate relative, have a special type of visa, or be a immediate family member. In Cuba, there are not enough of this type of individuals to go up to 20,000. So only in Cuba, in the whole world, do we offer a lottery program, not the diversity lottery that we offer around the world, but a program in which Cubans are encouraged to apply to be selected randomly to go to the United States so that we can fulfill that 20,000 visas a year to come to the United States to live. Now, on the other side of that, and I alluded to it just a little bit, are the non-immigrant visas, the people who want to come and just visit the United States. Last year, we only issued 8,500 of these visas. And that is in contrast to, say, 50,000 that we were issuing in 1993. And so we have made some significant changes in that front. First of all, we are interviewing more than four times as many applicants for non-immigrant visas, for visitor visas, now at the intersection than we were doing a year ago today. In addition, last year we issued about 8,500, as I indicated. This year we've already issued 10,500. That means if we keep up at this rate, we will issue 30 to 40,000 non-immigrant visas this year. This is really a significant increase in visas. The reason this has happened, in addition to streamlining the procedure, is that we have made a decision that we should look at Cubans like we look at the rest of the world and the Caribbean, that if people are 65 and above, we will assume, generally, if they can make some additional proofs, that they will return to Cuba, because we are talking about not issuing on the basis of they might remain in the United States. And so now I am really very pleased to say that there are so many more elderly people in Cuba that are having the chance, in the first time in many years, to see their families in Miami.
We have so many questions here still and so little time. One of the people here would like to have you comment on relations with the Soviet Union, between Cuba and the Soviet Union, and how they have changed since the changes in the relations with Russia, since the changes in the fall of the Soviet Union.
Oh, thank you. An easy one. You all must have a lot of interest in Cuba because your questions are really, really excellent. I very much appreciated it. I have to think a lot. On the Soviet Union, what amazes me is this huge embassy the Soviets built. I mean, it is, as you saw, sort of a monstrosity. Those that have been there, it's this huge block building with this great tower, and it sort of looks like something from The Empire Strikes Back. It is as if now in Cuba that the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe were never there. The Soviet Union, the Russian people, East Germans, Ukrainians, thousands were in Cuba over a 30-year period. And it is as if it never existed. There seemingly was just no affinity. And the Soviets did always keep the Cubans at arm's length and did not associate with them very much on a personal basis. But it is surprising. And maybe it is because, and this is anecdotal and something that people like to speculate on, some people say that before the revolution, Cubans were more North American, more like us, than any other nationality in Latin America. And then they say, and 41 years later, despite all the rhetoric, Cubans are still the most North American of the Latin Americans. Maybe that's it. The Soviet Union did not rub off. Yes, Soviet Union still has limited military relationship with Cuba, has a sugar for oil relationship with Cuba. It has an ambassador and a small staff. It has some influence in Cuba, but it is very, very much reduced. In fact, I would say that Cuba's relationship now with China is probably stronger than its relationship with the Soviet Union.
I'm going to try to get two more in very quickly. First of all, this person asks whether you see problems about drug trafficking in the following sense. There are patterns of narcotics flows from Colombia around eastern Cuba and also throughout the Caribbean. Do you foresee any kind of U.S. intervention near the territorial waters of Cuba around drug trafficking?
No. We will continue to cooperate with Cuba on narcotics trafficking, and this means communications between our Coast Guard and the Cuban Border Guard, so the Cuban Border Guard can alert us to trafficking coming out of Cuban water or Cuban airspace. That's what we mean by sharing in communications on narco trafficking. I do not see, at least without the permission of the Cuban government, any official U.S. attempt to stop narco trafficking in Cuban waters. If we get the permission from the Cuban government to go in, then the Coast Guard would go in, but not without that permission.
This is our last question, and we have a number of people asking this question in various forms. One form is, the restrictions against travel by U.S. citizens to Cuba is a sham and a farce. Isn't it time for us to drop these restrictions, which have increased the suffering of the Cuban people and made us the laughingstock of the world? That's one way to ask it. A second question is,
this is a friendly crowd.
If Cuba is such a repressive nation, why not lift the travel ban and let us see for ourselves how bad it is in Cuba? And a third way to ask it is, Cuba's a beautiful country. How can I get there to tour Cuba if you won't give me a visa?
Well, since I see a lot of sympathy for that question, let me be very precise on what you can do and what you should do. First of all, that's the point of the people-to-people program, is to allow people like yourselves that feel very strongly they want to see for themselves to get down to Cuba. So you join the Commonwealth. I should get paid for this club, and you join their tour, and you go down to Cuba, and you have a chance to see for yourself. And when you come, I'll be happy to invite you for a mojito at my residence, and I'll give you the same briefing that you've probably heard today. But I would be delighted to see any and all of you, because I think the other side of that coin is that the Cuban people see that we, the American people, aren't a threat. They also hear about how we conduct our lives in our societies, and I think it helps them get ready for a transition. We believe that about 140,000 people are coming to Cuba now from the United States a year. 100,000 of those are Cuban Americans traveling on humanitarian purposes. Another 20,000 are probably the people-to-people program. So let me encourage you to use that way to get to Cuba. It's better than just going and lying on the beach at the hotel. It's nice, but you can do that in other Caribbean countries, and you learn a lot more if you go with the Commonwealth Club, as the San Francisco Global Trade Council can tell you.
We have no more time. I would just like to add that the Commonwealth Club, Global Exchange, Stanford University Alumni Association, and many other groups are taking trips to Cuba for those of you who would like to go see some of these things for yourself. We want to really thank Ambassador Vicki Huddleston, who's the principal officer of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana, Cuba, for joining us today. We know you're there at a particularly interesting time and that you have the fortune to be there at a particularly interesting time. We want to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, as well as all of you listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.